أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين. ولعن الله الدائم على أعدائه أجمعين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. Respected ulama, sisters, brothers in Islam and Iman, we've gathered here tonight for the commemoration of the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam. And before I begin, I would like to thank Allah for this opportunity, and I want to thank the Imam Ali Center for hosting these programs and the Ahlul Bayt Learning Initiative for organizing the programs. May Allah reward all of you for your good intentions and for your efforts, and may Allah accept them all. And may you all be counted among those who mourn and help mourn the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Tonight, I would like to, inshallah, say a few words about the importance of why we're here, so that we can have a mindset, we can have an intention behind why we've come here. And I'd like to also introduce the topic that inshallah I'll be pursuing if Allah gives us the tawfiq in the nights to come. I want to begin with a tradition which is narrated from our sixth Imam alayhi salam. It's said that once he met a famous poet by the name of Ja'far al-Athai. And Ja'far was somebody who was known amongst the people. When the Imam alayhi salam comes across him, he says to him, "It has come to me that you compose poetry. I've heard that you compose poetry in remembrance of my grandfather, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So can you compose some of that poetry for me?" Now Ja'far agrees to see this poetry for Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And he says some poetry, and Imam alayhi salam cries. And then he tells him, "No, tell me some more of that poetry, that special poetry, that special stanza and poem that you've composed that I've heard of." So Ja'far agrees and he starts to say that poetry. And once again, the Imam alayhi salam begins to cry and cry. And after hearing this majlis and hearing this poetry, the Imam alayhi salam has a statement. He says that, "Oh Ja'far, do you know that while we were crying here, this gathering was witnessed by the angels, and it was heard by the people in the heaven, and they were shedding more tears, even more than we were shedding, while this poetry was being said." And he tells him that, "Ja'far, should I tell you what the reward is for what you've done?" And he says, "Yes, my master." He says that the reward for what you have done is Jannah, completely. And your sins have been forgiven as well too. And whoever composes something for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and who cries and causes others to cry, that person is deserving of paradise. And that's something which is not a small reward which is promised for this deed right here. This is just one of the incidents. There's others as well too. There's a story of Abu Harun al-Makfuf. Abu Harun was an elderly man who was filled with love of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. One time Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says to him, Abu Harun, come to my home. I want you to compose some poetry. He was famous for his eloquence. Abu Harun comes and the same sort of incident happens. The Imam alayhi salam tells him to speak. He speaks, he says his poetry. The Imam cries. The Imam alayhi salam puts up a partition. On one side there's the ladies of the home, and on the other side there's the men of the home. And he says to him, now continue, say some more. And Abu Harun says some more. And he says, says some more. And it goes on and on. And Imam alayhi salam, according to some reports, he was weeping so much that his shoulders were shaking out of grief. And then he tells him that, Abu Harun, even if you make 10 people cry for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, then you attain paradise. Abu Harun, even if you get 5 people, even if you make 1 other person, Abu Harun, even if the amount of a wingtip of a fly were to exit your eye in grief of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, your reward would be Jannah. When you read and you come across these traditions, brothers and sisters, you get the feeling that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is searching for the mourners of his grandfather. He is creating that opportunity and that incentive for people to come to the majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This tradition that we have every Muharram of clearing out our schedule, of taking that pain and trouble and the efforts to come to the centers and to remember what took place. We are following that tradition which was established by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And there's incredible value in these gatherings. But when we come here, my brothers and sisters, our purpose should not just end with the commemoration itself. There was one time many years ago when I was sitting with a group of brothers and sisters after one of the lectures, and it was a question and answer session. I still remember we were going around and people had different comments, had different questions. There was one brother who said something that until now it's still something that I reflect upon. He says that every time we go to the majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we hear about how Imam Hussein alayhi salam died. Why don't we ever hear about how Imam Hussein alayhi salam lived so that he could die in the way that he died? And this is something that really struck me. Because if we truly want to have ma'rifah and have awareness and knowledge of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his martyrdom, then we have to understand what is it that led to that taking place. Who is this person, Imam Hussein alayhi salam? So what I'd like to do, inshallah, if Allah gives us the tawfiq, is in these nights, I'm going to take this topic, and I'm going to take this topic of trying to understand the perspective of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. How is it that Imam Hussein alayhi salam used to view some very important concepts? And we're going to look at that and compare it to how other people view these concepts. This is a very important discussion for us to have. And the motivation for this comes from the Quran itself, from the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. The Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, they would encourage us to look at certain concepts that people talk about, but to look at them from a different light. I'll give you an example. There's a term which is called bir. In Arabic, bir means excessive goodness, or sometimes it's translated as piety. Somebody who does a lot of good acts. A tawassu'u fil khayr, meaning extensive goodness. Now, there was a historical issue that the Quran describes, which is called the changing of the Qibla. I'm sure that you've heard about this. There was a time when the Muslims were facing towards the west for their Qibla. The Kaaba was a place of worship for the mushrikeen. And the Muslims were commanded to take up the same direction of facing for their worship that the Jews were commanded to. And this was something that the Jews would take pride in, that look, if we have this, and look at the Muslims, you know, they're kind of doing the same thing that we're doing. But Rasulullah's, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, the heart of our beloved messenger, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, his heart was troubled because of this. And he desired to have a qibla which would be specific to the Muslims. And finally, after some time, Allah revealed the command, قَدْ نَرَىٰ تَقَلُّبَ وَجْهِكَ فِي السَّمَاءِ. We see that your face is turning in the sky. You're searching for your own qibla. فَوَلِّ وَجْهَكَ شَطْرَ الْمَسْجِدِ الْحَرَامِ. Your qibla is now going to be Masjid al-Haram. Your qibla is going to be towards the Kaaba. And this was a major event that led to the strength and the dignity of the Muslims at that time. But it also led to a lot of discussion and debate, because the Christians were facing towards the east, the Jews were facing to the west, and the Muslims now had their own qibla. And amidst this debate about whether we're going to turn this way or that way, Allah reveals a verse of the Quran. He says that لَيْسَ الْبِرَّ أَن تُوَلُّوا وُجُوهَكُمْ قِبْلَ الْمَشْرِقِ وَالْمَغْرِبِ. If you want to know, if you're searching to be a very good person, that doesn't lie in whether you're going to point to the east or to the west. You follow the command of God. You submit to that. Don't think once God has revealed the verse and the command in the Quran, then you follow that. Then he says, وَلَكِنَّ الْبِرِ. That bir that you're arguing about, you want to attain that goodness, that is found in those people who do what? Okay, it's found in those people who believe in Allah, and believe in the messengers, and believe in the holy books. وَلَكِنَّ الْبِرَّ مَنْ آمَنَ بِاللَّهِ وَالْيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ وَالْمَلَائِكَةِ وَالْكِتَابِ وَالنَّبِيِّينَ. Allah clarifies the situation. This term, bir, you're looking at it as being something which is very limited to which direction you're pointing it. But Allah is defining for us something which is greater, something which is deeper. Bir is found through imitating the example of the likes of the Ahlul Bayt, those exemplars who have been set forth, and those who represent the message of this verse. So you see, the Quran is taking this concept of bir and it's redefining that concept. Okay? Now, that's one example. I'll give you another example from history. I want to set the stage for what we're going to discuss, inshallah, in this series. This next example comes from the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen. There was a certain time where the Khawarij, those who were at war with Imam alayhi salam, those who in many ways were opposing him for various reasons, they had a slogan that they had taken for themselves. Imam alayhi salam one time was giving a khutbah after the Battle of Siffin. And as he's giving the khutbah, one man stands up in the mosque. And, you know, they say heckling, right? So he's a heckler. So he stands up in the mosque and he shouts out, La hukma illa lillah. There is no rulership except for Allah. Allah is the only ruler. And Imam Ali just pauses, waits for the man to quiet down, and then he continues khutbah. Once again, after some time, another man stands up and challenges him, La hukma illa lillah. There is no rulership except for with Allah. Once again pauses, and after some time continues, it happens again, three times. And then Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam says something which is very interesting, and it's captured in Nahj al-Balagha. He says, كَلِمَةُ حَقٍ يُرَادُ بِهِ الْبَاطِلِ. This word that they're saying is something which is true, but what they mean by it is something which is false. What they mean by this concept is لَا حُكْمَ إِلَّا لِلَّهِ, meaning that there is no position for anybody to be a ruler over the Muslims. Any ruler is illegitimate. But that's not the correct understanding of this concept. La hukma illa lillah, for example, it could mean that Allah is the one who is the hakim. Allah is the one who makes the laws. Allah is the one who calls the shots. He's the one who runs the affairs. But Allah has told us that you need to have leadership. That you need to have somebody who can, otherwise the whole society is going to crumble. And he begins to explain, you know, the political science theory of Islam. This is part of it in this sermon in Nahj al-Balagha. So, my point is what? My point is that whether it be the concept of bir in the Quran, whether it be the concept of hukm or hukumat, as they say, if when you want to translate it into like, you know, turn it into like a more Farsi or an Urdu version of it, the idea of rulership and leadership, the Quran or the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, they are calling us to try to understand these concepts in the correct way, from the correct perspective. Now, one of these terms that I want to just introduce tonight is the term Islam itself. What does it mean to be a Muslim? What is it? What is the religion of Islam about? What does it entail? This is one of the concepts that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, throughout the struggle, he was trying to convey to the people that that Islam that is being practiced right now, that's not Islam. Don't get confused. I wish to define for you what is true Islam. You all know the famous incident that took place when Marwan comes to Imam Hussein alayhi salam and he says that I order you by the order of the Khalifa Yazid. I order you to do what? I order you to give allegiance to him. And that is something which is better for you in the dunya and the akhirah. You know, you're not going to be in trouble in this world, just give him the allegiance, right? And in the akhirah, that's something that you can also do as well too. What did Imam Hussein alayhi salam say in his response? One of the most famous sayings of Imam Hussein. He says, وَعَلَى الْإِسْلَامِ السَّلَامِ. Upon Islam, I bid farewell. If it's the case that this ummah is tried with a leader like Yazid. What is Imam Hussein alayhi salam trying to tell us with that statement? There is an Islam which is being introduced, an Islam which is being promoted, a change in Islam that will take place should Yazid become the leader, and I am somebody who endorses that leadership, which will change the nature of Islam. And so, when we're gathering to remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam, one of the things we can ask ourselves is that what is that original, pure Islam that Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam is trying to remind the people about? So let's go back and see what were some of the trends that were going on at the time. What sort of diversions and what sort of movements were taking place to push Islam away from its pure form, to dilute it and to pollute it. One of those trends that was taking place at that time was the separation of the religion from politics. This is something which you can very easily realize if you study the history of Islam. Muawiyah la'anatullahi alayh, when he came into power and he started to take over, at one, there's one incident that's captured in history. He went to the people he was ruling and he told them that my being the ruler over you, don't worry. You're still going to be able to pray in your mosques. You're still going to be able to carry out your rites and your rituals. But what's going to change is that I am now going to be the political ruler over you. And our scholars, like Imam Khomeini rahmatullahi alayhi, like our existing contemporary Maharaja, they've explained to us that what was happening here was a fundamental change in the nature of leadership. You see, after Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam passed away, that position of the leader, at least the people who were there, even though they didn't rightly belong there, at least they still tried to take on, you know, the perspective and try to portray the image of being somebody who is a Muslim leader following the principles of Islam. But with Muawiyah coming into power, there was a change taking place. It was turning away from being a spiritual leader position, the idea of leadership being given to the one who's going to be a spiritual leader, to becoming a purely political leader. So this is one of the diversions that was taking place in Islam. And Imam Hussein al-Islam wanted to stand up and to show the people that this was incorrect. And this is very important for us, brothers and sisters. Because when we start to look at Islam as being just something that's for the centers and for the mosques, and has nothing to do with guiding our social and political life, then we're taking the path that the Bani Umayyah was propagating amongst the Muslims at that time. That's one example. Another example is the movement of the Murji'a. I don't know if you've heard this term before. There was a problem that the Bani Umayyah were facing at the time, which was this idea that they knew they were openly committing sins. And they knew that people, you know, were doing Amr Ma'ruf and Nahy Munkar. They needed a way to be able to retain their power and still be able to commit sins. So one of the people at one time, he says to Muawiyah, he says that, you know who you're fighting, you know who you're going against. You're going against Ali ibn Abi Talib. And it was very clear to the Muslims at that time that anybody who goes against Imam Ali alayhi salam is definitely wrong. They're definitely committing a sin. So it's very interesting the way Muawiyah responded to this objection. He tells the people that, I know I'm doing something wrong, but I have hope that I will be forgiven because إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَغْفِرُ الذُّنُوبَ جَمِيعًا. And this idea of indeed Allah forgives all, this became the beginning of a theological movement. The idea that you can commit any sin that you want as long as you have faith in your heart. Just have faith, do whatever you want, and everything will be fine. It kind of sounds familiar, right? Like, I don't know if you've ever spoken to, for example, you know, you speak to, let's say, people who are practicing Catholics, right? We'll say that, you know, we know what we need to do in order to get our penitence. We just need to go and go into our confession booth in the church on Sunday, and we say what we did, we pay a little money, right? And there we go, these are forgiven. It's not about what you do, it's about having faith in your heart, whatever that means. And of course, you know, the teachings of the Shia Madhab is that this is absolutely wrong. Iman is not something that you just have in your heart. Iman is something that is coupled with amal, is coupled with action. And somebody who, you know, just has this false claim of iman, but doesn't back it up with amal, then, you know, there's no guarantee that that person will be saved from the fire of the hell, right? Now, but this became a movement, right? This became a major issue to the point where we have a number of ahadith from our imams warning people against this movement. It's very interesting, you know, like our imams, alayhi salam, they were very particular about telling parents to take care of what their children are exposed to, the ideologies that they would be facing. One of the ideologies that we have specifically mentioned in hadith is the murji'ah, this idea that just be a good person, doesn't really matter what you do to back that up. That was something that our imam specifically warned. It said that teach your children our teachings before those murji'ah get to them. Because that's that type of thing. It's attractive for somebody, for a young person who wants to, you know, let's say, enjoy the dunya. It's very comfortable, right? I just got, you know, I just have faith in my heart, and then I can do whatever I want. Why am I mentioning this? I'm mentioning some of the ways that Islam was being diverted and it was being polluted from its original form. And we have Imam Hussein alayhi salam who's saying that وَعَلَى الْإِسْلَامِ السَّلَامِ. We are going to bid farewell to Islam if Yazid is going to take power and nobody does anything to stop this. Now we want to draw a lesson from this to our times right now. And when you look at what's happening to Islam in the current day, we see similar sorts of challenges being brought against it. You could talk about this version of Islam, which is a very comfortable version of Islam, the idea that you never speak up against any injustice, right? You just kind of go along with the flow, you have your, make sure that you, you know, recite your prayers and come into your centers, as long as that's there, then, you know, never have to speak out against any sort of injustice. You have a type of Islam which is very comfortable with this idea of being spiritual, but not necessarily being committed to following rules. Right, you have an Islam which is being promoted by, let's say, the likes of Daesh and ISIS, which is, you know, let's go and sort of show, you know, all the teeth that we can and sort of be very fierce in a way scare people away from the deen. Like, we have all these different versions, and for somebody who's a practicing Muslim, this should be something that worries us. It should be something that's concerning us, the idea that Islam is being used as a means of misguidance. Our Maharaja have told us that one of our important duties to the Ummah, one of our important duties for our children, if we want to pass along Islam to the next generation, is to understand what true Islam is about, and to convey that to them, and to show people through our action that this is what true Islam is about. There's a lot of different aspects we could talk about, but it's just one practical example. It's the idea of there being an absolute equality amongst humanity. You see, when people want to challenge true Islam, they don't necessarily come at it in a direct sort of way. Sometimes it's through very careful and clever statements. One of the ways that people are trying to dilute the true message of Islam is by promoting this idea of absolute equality. That in every circumstance, no matter what we have to make sure is that everyone and everything is equal. So, for example, if it's the case that in traditional Islam, it would be the case that if men and women are going to pray together, there has to be, you know, a sort of barrier between them, or there has to be, let's say the women are in the back, or something of the sort. If you want absolute equality, then there shouldn't be a barrier. There shouldn't be any back and front. In fact, it shouldn't even be the case that a man is leading the prayer. I don't know if you saw the pictures from this year, 2017, from Germany. It was very interesting. They had a Friday prayer, and they wanted to be absolutely equal, right? So what they had is they had two imams. One of them was a man, and one of them was a woman. It's kind of like a joint imamah of the jama'ah prayers. So, seriously, you see the picture, and it's like, okay, absolute equality. Absolute equality. Which means that if Islam, for example, tells us that there's special guidelines and rulings when it comes to the way that we would interact on some issues with those people of the book versus those people who are not of the book. For example, on issues of Tahara and Nadasa, well, that would be against this absolute principle of equality. Absolute equality, if that means that in Islam, you know, there's this idea, for example, of within a family there being complementary rights, but not necessarily equal rights, well, that's something that we need to challenge. Because our rationalistic, moral compass tells us that, you know what, there has to be equality in all circumstances. But if, for example, and there's so many examples we have, if, for example, let's say Islamic law tells us that when it comes to organ donation, who we can take organs from and who we can give organs to, let's say, for example, according to Muslim law, there's preferential treatment given to Muslims. Well, this absolute equality thing comes in and says that, well, that's not something that we can tolerate. No, and this is something that people who grow up in this society where this idea of equality is being pushed to the maximum, right? Sometimes when they face, you know, certain teachings in Islam which tell us that absolute equality is not the key to success, they face difficulties with that. So how do we respond to this? I'm just going to give you some perspective on it, inshallah, then we'll wrap up for tonight. Brothers and sisters, these people who promote absolute equality, who talk about human rights, and say that Islam, if you practice it in the way that it's been taught, in the way that it's been, you know, passed along from generation to generation, they say that it violates some aspect of human rights. It's something which goes against equality. Well, you have to ask this question that in Western society, in, for example, the society we live in America, do we really have an equal and fair and just society? Anybody who looks at what's going on would realize that this system that's been developed, it's a system which has inherent problems in it. Systemic racism. Right? If you go and look at what's happening, just as one example, all the type of injustice that's been happening to the African American community. Right? It's something which is unbelievable. Just in these last years, like last couple of years, look at how many incidents have taken place where you have a white police officer who goes and shoots an innocent citizen for just being a citizen and then faces no consequences. You look at statistics about housing and income inequality, about prison imprisonment, and you see that this society is not something which is based on equality. In the name of human rights, you see a lot of injustice taking place. And then you go abroad and you see these same countries that talk about human rights and equality, and you see how much inequality and how much injustice is being perpetrated by these same entities, by these same countries. That's number one. Number two is that people who are pushing for the idea of absolute equality, if we ask them this question that, okay, does that mean that when we deal with people, we shouldn't deal with them differently depending on who we're dealing with? For example, like let's say that you're talking to your mother or your father versus talking to, you know, some stranger on the street. Wouldn't you naturally want to treat your mother and father in a different way than you would some just random Joe on the street? Right? Anybody would accept that. Right? There's part of living in a society and part of interacting with others is that you want to establish fairness and you want to treat people fairly, which means that you are going to treat people differently in order to achieve that balance and that fairness. It's something which is common. With your parents, you always are going to speak respectfully. You always are going to, for example, swallow your anger. You're always going to take the extra effort to see what you can do to please them. That's something which basic human values teach us. And then, for example, the original Islam, it comes and tells us even more. It emphasizes that and makes it something which is a wajib duty of a child. But let's say there's some average Joe on the street. Okay, I'll be respectful, I'll be kind, but I'm not necessarily going to go to the same extent as I'm going to go with my parents. So this is something that already is accepted, that when you're dealing with people, you are going to deal with them in a different way. That doesn't mean that you're being discriminatory, that you're being unfair. It's part of the way that you deal with people. And the third point that I'd like to make is that when it comes to dealing with people, Islam is something which teaches us a very beautiful code of conduct. There are so many teachings in Islam where it tells us that we're dealing with anybody, we deal with them with fairness and kindness and justice. Of course, if they're not somebody who's an aggressor and somebody who's a tyrant. But for the most part, we look at our traditions, they say they treat people with justice. I'll give you some examples. When we have... Excuse me, can you say salawat? We have, for example, the teaching of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam that you've all heard before, when Malik Ashtar is going and he's going to be ruling over people who are both Muslim and non-Muslim. Right? What Imam alayhi salam tells him that whether it be somebody who is let your heart be filled with mercy and love to the people, show kindness to them, for they belong to one of two groups. Either they are your brother in faith or your peer in creation. Right? Show kindness to them. We have, for example, from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, if a Jewish person comes and sits in your company, make it a good city. Make it a good city. They're a Jewish person, they're not from your faith, but make it a good city. From Imam Al-Hasan alayhi salam, it says, if you treat people like you wish to be treated, you will be just, the golden rule. Okay. At the same time, we have traditions which tell us to be careful. Imam Ali alayhi salam, be cautious of the homes of heedlessness and remoteness from Islamic etiquette, where there are few to assist in obeying Allah. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, it is not up to you to sit with whomever you please. Be careful. You see, Islam has a very rich set of guidelines. On one hand, it tells us you interact with people with justice, but when it comes to taking company with somebody, spending time with them in a way that you're going to be affected, you're going to learn from them, you're going to sort of take on the same path in life, then you be careful. So this idea of there being an absolute principle of equality, it's something which, when you look at it, it might sound appealing initially, but when you see Muslims pushing for it, then it's something you have to be careful about. And one thing I want to mention, and the last thing I'll mention before going to the Musiwa portion, is that we have to be careful. You know, just recently there's been some reports that say that there are millions of dollars being poured into American Muslim organizations with an agenda. An agenda is what? The agenda is to make these organizations drop their fundamental values, to accept the liberal values of, for example, openness when it comes to sexual morality, openness when it comes to same-sex marriage, openness when it comes to, you know, being tolerant about certain political entities. You know, we don't want those anymore. So there's millions of dollars being poured into American Muslim organizations for that. This is something that, as people who learn the lessons from Abu Abdullah Hussein Islam, we have to take note of this. We have to make sure that in our own lives and in the practice of our institutions, that this type of ideology does not creep in. May Allah Ta'ala help us to understand the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, apply it in our lives and spread it to our youth. Salawat, please. Allah. Allah. Brothers and sisters, it is the second night of the month of Muharram, and on this night we wish to recount the tragedy of what befell the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And traditionally, in some of the cultures, they go through the musibah of entering Karbala on this night. Inshallah, in the English language, I'll mention some words. Inshallah, Sayyid, Brother Mahdi, inshallah, will be sharing some words in Turkish language. Brothers and sisters, leaving home is not something which is an easy thing to do. Somebody who travels from home, there's a part of them that is always longing and yearning for the time they can come back. And for the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, the city of Medina was something which had particular significance, something which they had particular attachment to. This was the home of their beloved grandfather. This was the center and the capital of the establishment of the Islamic State. This was their source of comfort, and you can imagine that for a child to be leaving a home not knowing where they're going to go to, not knowing how long it's going to take, it's something which is very scary for them. And that's why we see that in the month of Rajab, 3 months before, for example, roughly speaking, that when the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam are leaving the city of Medina, we have a report from the daughter of Imam Hussein alayhi salam who says that never before has there been a family who is more fearful and scared of what is to come than we were at that time. It was very frightening for us. Who are these individuals who are leaving their home and going out not knowing where they're going to end up in? We have the likes of Zainab alayhi salam. We have the likes of Sukaina, Ruqayya. We have the likes of Fatima bint al-Husayn. It is a very long journey they are about to undertake. From the time that they left Makkah, it was 24 days until the second day of Muharram, when they finally enter the land of Qatar. What we're told in the reports is that when Imam Hussein alayhi salam comes to this land, he asks, he says that, what is this land known as? And they told him this is Shakti Turat. They gave him some names for it. And then he says, according to some of the report, is there any other name for it? And they told him it is a land of Qarb. And he says that indeed, this is a place of Qarb and Bala. This is a land of difficulty. This is a land of Bala, of trial. It is a land where my father, according to some of the reports, he says that my father, when he came to this land, he himself took some of the sand from it and he smelled it. And he says that this is the place where many of the prophets and their successors have been buried. This is the place where the shuhada will be buried. This is the place where blood will be spilled. And Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam tells the people that indeed this is the place where we will alight, our caravan is going to stop. This is the place where we will pitch our tents. And this is the place where our blood will be spilled. And you can imagine, brothers and sisters, that when the children were hearing this, and when Zainab alayhi salam was hearing this, what is going through her mind at that time? Because she knows that this is the land in which the blood of the men will be spilled. But what about the women and the children? What will happen to them? As she is entering Karbala, she is accompanied by the likes of Abbas and Ali Akbar, by the likes of her brother Imam Hussein alayhi salam. But she knows that when she will be leaving Karbala, They will not be there with her to accompany the caravan. She will be the one who will be leaving there. She will be alone with the children and, of course, Imam Sadat alayhi salam in his situation. On the night of Ashura, we're told that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he tells his companions, he tells them that if you wish to leave, you can take the darkness of the night as your cover. Go, take one of my family members with you. And one by one, we're told that they stood and they re-pledged their allegiance to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Among them, brothers and sisters, we have the likes of Abbas alayhi salam. He too has to stand up. He too tells Imam Hussein alayhi salam that we will never leave your side. But not once, brothers and sisters, do we have any report that says that Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam was included in this request. That Imam Hussein alayhi salam told her that Zainab, it's okay for you to go as well. Because Zainab's role was something which was very important. She did not have that luxury to be able to leave Karbala. She was the one who was going to carry forward the caravan at that time. And what we're told is that Zainab alayhi salam, as she is leaving Karbala, that is the time where we have the first majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. As we gather for these majalis, we are following the spirit of Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam. When she is mourning and she is causing everyone to cry, even according to the reports, that the tears were shedding from the eyes of the horses when they saw Zainab alayhi salam crying out, Ilahi taqabbal minna hadha al-qurban. And Zainab alayhi salam turns toward Medina. She says to Rasulullah, Ya Rasulullah, accept from us, this is Hussein alayhi salam. He is here and he is in blood. Here your daughter is taken captive, your offspring is slaughtered, and Hussein is in the desert covered with blood, his limbs have been cut off. Allah la'anatullahi alayhi wa sallam.